bad. Now the boat won't float, I don't like it. I'm too proud to be born. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore.
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you in the air on listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign at 90.1 FM. That's Champaign, Illinois, 90.1 FM, and webcasting live worldwide at WFT.org. The views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Bob with some other announcements.
The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio. And programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber. He believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. And the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And this hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at the Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon in Urbana. For more information, visit www.centraliljwj.org. That's centraliljwj.org.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. We're going to be having a special guest call in at half past the hour, Mark Dudzik. He's a coordinator of the National Labor Campaign for Single Payer, and he's going to be calling to talk a little bit about their – we talked to him back in June, July, and there was a upcoming at that point, an upcoming single payer healthcare conference that was going to be happening in Oakland, California in August. So he's going to give a quick little brief update of what happened there. Then he's going to go into what happened most recently in Vermont, where the governor of Vermont, Shumlin, basically sold out the single-payer movement and said that it couldn't be implemented, even though it was one of his big campaign promises. And we got a news story on that, too, about the reaction of a lot of citizens of Vermont to that. So, yeah, stay tuned for that. And in the meantime, I guess we'll go do some news stories. Bob?
Okay, this is something that you mentioned a month or so ago, Dave, about the truck drivers out there in the ports in Los Angeles and Long Beach and stuff. So yesterday, there was a press conference in Wilmington, and it validates truck drivers were there to validate their union authorization cards, and this opens the door for the Teamsters to begin negotiating. It says here that port truck drivers from the Shippers Transport Express, a wholly owned subsidiary of SSA Marine, have designated Teamsters Local 848 as their exclusive bargaining representative and will now begin the process of negotiating a collective bargaining agreement with their employer. Prior to January 1st, 2015, the drivers were classified as independent contractors. In November, all drivers were notified that the company was transitioning to an employee-based business model as of January 1st and were invited to apply for employee jobs. It says here, this has been a long struggle, and we're grateful that shippers agreed to remain neutral during our campaign to become Teamsters, said Mike Acosta, a port truck driver employed by shippers. As Teamsters and professional port truck drivers, we look forward to working with management to move port cargo more efficiently and to modernize the industry. It says here about the landmark agreement, effective January 1st, 2015. Shippers Transport Express converted from an independent contractor business model to an employee-based drayage business. All drivers were notified. And so this includes the following provisions. Shippers agreed not to interfere in employees' decisions regarding unionization. They agreed not to use intimidation, threats of reprisal, promise of benefits, or other conduct or speech designed to intimidate or coerce the drivers to influence the decisions by its employees' drivers. To be represented by the Teamsters. So that went into effect, and yesterday they signed their authorization cards.
Oh, great, great. Yeah, it was just, I mean, gosh, it's ridiculous. I mean, you know, this started back in the late, when they deregulated the trucking industry back, I think it was 79. And, you know, these drivers, I mean, they have to pay for their own gas. I mean, right. All the
Thank
expenses.
You, Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, well, you know what? Jimmy Carter... you know, he was reluctant neoliberal, and that's why they, you know, basically, powers that be got rid of him. But nevertheless, I mean, he has to live with that, the fact that both deregulation of the trucking industry and the airline industry and, starting the CIA to organize, and arm, these Islamic, fundamentalists, people in Afghanistan to undermine the very progressive government that was there at that time.
Well, you know, I also liked it when we had one phone company, too.
Indeed. I remember right after high school, my phone
Things
bill.
Things were simpler.
My local phone bill every month was $8 and some change. Now, making a long-distance phone call was a little pricey.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But now, look at it. You know, it's like,
And we went through years of those people disturbing our dinners every night when they were calling up to try and slam you over to another phone service.
Yes. Right. Yeah.
Well, besides that, it's like every time you make a deal, then something else pops up, and it's like, man, I just screwed myself for 2 years.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay, if you know anything about the checkered history of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you know that it's coming. Despite the attitude of the Democratic Party, which is a strong contingent in opposition, President Obama and former President Bill Clinton and future possible, hopefully not, President Hillary Clinton, are all supporting the Trans-Pacific Partnership. President Obama is in a perfect position to get the Trans-Pacific Partnership passed. While there was a Democratic majority in the Senate, passage was in doubt. But now he can work with a Republican majority to get it enacted, and that is precisely where he is headed. What is wrong with the Trans-Pacific Partnership? It's NAFTA on steroids. Here's how it works. As in NAFTA, there will be whole sections in the Trans-Pacific Partnership that override important national laws regarding labor, environmental regulations, and the like. Under the U.S. Constitution, a treaty overrides both state and federal law, so the Trans-Pacific Partnership will be the superior law. If a foreign company believes that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is in conflict with American law, it can bring a lawsuit. But the lawsuit isn't brought into a court in the United States, but before a Trans-Pacific Partnership arbitration panel somewhere in the world comprised of private lawyers, some of whom are precisely responsible for drafting the Trans-Pacific Partnership in the first place. And whatever the panel decides goes, regardless of national, state, or local laws. Under NAFTA, for example, FedEx actually sued the Canadian Post Office before a NAFTA arbitration panel, arguing that the Canadian government was undercutting FedEx's business in favor of the Post Office. Fortunately, even the private lawyers in the tribunal rejected that claim at the time. But if they hadn't, Canada would have had to shell out millions of dollars to FedEx. And here's the kicker. If FedEx doesn't like that the U.S. Post Office is what it's doing, it can sue under NAFTA, as it will also be able to do under the Trans-Pacific Partnership by having one of its foreign subsidiaries bring the lawsuit. In other words, an American company can sue its own government in a private court and collect U.S. taxpayer money by asserting a treaty against rules the company doesn't like. So watch out for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, all you who want to protect American sovereign rights, because once it's enacted, our entire legal system is up for grabs. And for those of you who are Democrats, you can thank your beloved president for the result.
Man.
Yeah. I got a story here out of India, since we're the World Labor Hour. It says over 500,000 coal miners in India have ended a planned 5-day strike after 2 days as the government gave assurances not to privatize Coal India Limited, CIL. Industrial Global Union coal mining affiliates led the massive strike, which ended on the 7th of January. following a marathon 6-hour long meeting between the leaders of the 5 trade union centers that called the strike and Coal India chairman and senior officials. India's coal and power minister Piyush Goyal told reporters there is no intention for denationalization of CIL. The present and future interest of CIL employees will not be affected in any manner. CIL will be protected, and there's no need be any apprehension about its ownership or management going into private hands. So government established a committee to consider other union demands, and it says besides the no denationalization of Coal India, steps have been taken to further strengthen the organization. They're also looking at job security and service conditions of workers being protected and housing and hygiene conditions of workers' townships renovated within 1 year. The government also made it very clear that no vindictive actions will be initiated against workers for their participation in the strike, and the unions have committed to improve production and improve efficiency. Coal India is the world's largest mining employer, producing 472 million tons annually. Like they say, 500,000 coal miners. They did go on strike for 2 days, and evidently the government of India decided it was better to meet the workers' demands and non-privatize. The new Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi's government, has been looking to privatize several other industries in India. So
I almost brought that news story, and I, you know what, when I read that, I had no idea how large the coal industry was in India.
Amazing. A 500,000 coal miners, you know, that says that they produce 60% of India's electricity, and that company alone produces 80% of the country's coal.
So. Well, yeah, but I mean, do they have, what kind of mining techniques do they have? They might have a lot more labor-intensive techniques.
Probably so.
Yeah. Because I've heard of places like where you pour concrete, you don't have concrete pumps, so you do a wall by shoveling from scaffold to scaffold to scaffold till you get the way we've done hod carrying stuff here occasionally.
Yeah, they probably don't have much mechanization there, and they're probably not doing mountaintop removal like they do here. That doesn't require but about one person to blow up a mountain.
Yeah.
But, it's really bad that there are actually 500,000 coal miners in India, and that there are coal miners in the United States and anywhere in the world, because it's pretty well destroying the habitat.
Yeah, right.
It's a very large contributor, and I would hope that nations like India and
the United States,
but I mean a lot of nations that aren't already industrialized, that they leapfrog the way they did with telephones.
Yeah, right.
They didn't have to go through the whole thing of putting wires up all over the place. They got cell phones,
right?
You know, so let's leapfrog that into give everybody in India solar panels.
Yeah,
there you go.
Yeah, let's start here and then give them to India. I mean, that's the thing is, I mean, you know, of course, the utility companies, they don't want that. I mean, they want to have big panel arrays that they own somewhere out in a big, huge open area as opposed to everyone having them on their own homes.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That was the whole idea behind the power companies to begin with. We've had every farm here used to have, instead of having an electric water pump, you had a windmill. They were all over here.
Yep.
You know, when we were kids.
Yep.
There's very few left now. And we've always known that.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no reason ever for there to have been centralized electrical generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah. Went the way of the cooperative grain elevators that you used to see everywhere.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, they're all
now
still,
they're all privately owned by corporations. You know.
Well, no, basically
call
they are
co-ops.
Yeah.
Well, no, like the BMET Grain Company.
Yeah.
Well, it's actually now called Top Flight because they bought too many elevators in other towns.
Mm.
They didn't want to go into Monticello and put BMET grain across the grain elevator there. Man, that wouldn't have sat too well.
Okay, this is from the Daily Kos. On their second day in session in the House, the U.S. House voted on a bill designed to weaken the most important protections of the Dodd-Frank Financial Regulation Act. Fortunately, the bill didn't meet the necessary two-thirds vote threshold, but 35 Democrats voted with Republicans and almost allowed the bill to pass. Dodd-Frank was passed in an attempt to prevent another 2008 financial crisis by lowering risk in various parts of the U.S. financial system. Since its passage, Republicans and Democrats in league with Wall Street have done their best to eliminate its most important protections and leave the U.S. vulnerable to another economic crisis. Votes like this are calculated moves on the part of corporate Democrats to please corporate donors. This isn't the first offense for many of these bad actors, and we'll likely see more votes like this over the next 2 years. Every time a Democrat abandons their principles to shill for corporations at the expense of their constituents, we must let them know we are watching and won't forget when it comes to the reelection. And I'm not going to read all 35 names of the Democrats, but I am going to read the five from Illinois. And their names are the list of shame here of the Illinois House, U.S. House Democrats who voted for this bill. Was Cherry Bustos, the Illinois 17th Congressional District, Bill Foster of the Illinois 11th Congressional District, Dan Lipinski of the Illinois 3rd Congressional District, Mike Quigley of the Illinois 5th Congressional District, and this last one really shocked me, Bobby Rush of the Illinois 1st Congressional District. Hmm. Bobby Rush, I don't know what's going on with him. I mean, he used to be a really great House representative, and I don't know what's happened to him in the recent year or so. I do know from seeing a Sun-Times headline back, what was it about, I think in the spring, that he's under some kind of federal investigation for misuse of funds for some foundation he set up. So maybe they got the goods on him and are, you know, twisting his, you know what.
Blackmailing him.
Yeah, indeed. So, I mean, I can't think of any other explanation for it. But anyway, working class Americans across the country are hurting, and I'm disgusted at a time when we need more and better jobs for working people that they would vote to deregulate Wall Street. The so-called Promoting Job Creation Reducing Small Business Burdens Act is a Wall Street handout, and they should be ashamed for voting for it.
I saw another WEFT airshifter who posted something, and he noted that this happened on the first day of the Republican. And this was about their playing around with Social Security.
I was going to mention that. Thank you, Bob. If you want to kind of give a little report on that. So we're getting it from both ends as usual.
No, it's just ridiculous. You know, they're in power for one day and they're already going to start screwing everything up, you know. And that was, transitioning money between the various disability, the Social Security disability, which has happened many times in the past. Mm-hmm. And Republicans are saying now, well, it won't happen anymore in the future.
Yeah.
You know? So,
yeah, we'll see. It's going to be an interesting next 2 years, both nationally and here in the state level too. Yeah. So
I got a quick little story here. You know, we've all been kind of cheering the lower gas prices and stuff, but evidently not the people in Lorain, Ohio.
Oh.
Cause, U.S. Steel says that they're going to lay off 636 workers as part of a temporary idling of its Lorain tubular operations in Lorain, Ohio. Also, they're going to lay off like 140 workers in a plant down in Houston, Texas. It says low gas prices and a decrease in global oil exploration have led to declining demand for the plant, which makes oil country tubular goods used in exploration and drilling for oil and natural gas. So anyway, this takes effect March 4th, I believe, and over the next couple of weeks after that, and they're going to be laid off for as much as 3 to 4 months. This happened because, the layoffs start March 8th in 2 weeks, and additional layoffs occurring in May. So this happened because of, they put this out because of the WARN Act, the W-A-R-N Act, which is Worker Adjustment and Retraining Notification. Which says you got to give people prior notice of layoffs and stuff. So.
Oh, well, it's 60 days, right? Or
something like that,
the plant closure.
Right. So.
Yeah, I remember that. That came up in the 80s, wasn't it?
I think so.
A lot of plants were closing.
Yeah.
Hey, do you have 1 minute for some Bill Maher?
Sure. I'm not a big fan of Bill Maher, even though I do like some of his statements, but others, I just rub me the wrong way. But he's a mixed bag. I like some of the stuff he does. What do you have from him?
Well, but this is, it's a comment. Part of a long comment on the police, and this is about police unions.
Okay.
And it kind of expresses some of my feelings about police unions and prison guard unions.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And I'm going to have to do some on-the-fly editing here, so you might hear a little, some clicks or something, because I'll unplug this to cut a word out.
All right.
Okay. Have you got it punched up there?
Yep.
All righty.
You know what? Is actually not such a big stretch. The president of the Cleveland Police Union said killing the 12-year-old with the toy gun was justified. It was the police union in New York that encouraged the work stoppage. It's the union that's fighting the reasonable idea that cops should wear cameras. This is why Americans hate unions now. It's why Republicans have been able to make taking on the unions an applause line. Because union baby made it easy for them to make it about crybabies and entitlement. Which is a shame, because with a record wealth gap, we need unions now more than ever. When America had a thriving middle class, 1 in 3 workers had a union. Now it's 1 in 10. It's not hard to do the math, except in this country, because we can't fire teachers.
Okay. A little joke there at the end about firing teachers. We all know that's not true.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, you know, But let me say this. If a teacher's union,
at will employees.
Try to say that, criticize a school board member or principal, saying that a proven pedophile teacher should not be hired in any educational institution.
Oh.
They would just be reamed like you wouldn't know. But of course, the police union, that's supposedly a different story. Okay. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Mark Dudzik. I'm calling in for David Johnson.
Yes, Mark, this is David. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, David.
Okay. Well, let's see. Last time you were on the World Labor Hour, I think it was back in June or July, and you were speaking at that time about an upcoming conference on single-payer labor and single-payer in Oakland, California. Maybe you could just give us a little quick synopsis of what happened there and then go into what happened just recently in Vermont and what's going on nationwide.
Okay, sure. Yeah, we had our national strategy conference at the end of August, as you said, in Oakland, California. It was our first meeting ever on the West Coast, and it was our largest conference that we ever organized, and really kind of confirmed that the popular enthusiasm for a long-term single-payer solution to the healthcare crisis just continues to grow. This is also the first time that we met jointly with a number of other healthcare justice groups, a grassroots organization called Healthcare Now, scheduled their conference at the same time, and a group of state single-payer reform organizations called One Payer States was also there, as were some large number of West Coast grassroots healthcare reform groups. So it was a real exciting conference, a chance to exchange ideas and talk about where we go next. I think from the takeaways from that conference and, you know, what we've been kind of trying to implement since then is, you know, number one, from the perspective of the labor movement and of people who have to work for a living, the crisis has not gone away. The employment-based health care is still under, you know, major assault. Employers are constantly shifting costs and cutting benefits onto the backs of those least able to afford that, on the backs of their workers and retired workers around the country in both the private and the public sector. It's still the biggest cause of strikes and lockouts and concession bargaining for union members. And in a lot of ways, the Affordable Care Act makes it even more difficult to continue to fight for quality health care benefits at the bargaining table. So that dynamic is really driving growing labor support and interest in the single-payer fight. And then
Stop for a second and
sure.
Maybe explain that statement about how the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is making it more difficult? Because I think a lot of people out there are under the mistaken impression that the Affordable Care Act has solved all our health care crisis, is a step in the right direction. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Oh, wait a minute, Dave.
Yes.
The laborers were going up. Our deductibles, our co-payments are going up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's getting worse. It's getting less my care is getting less affordable.
Okay. Thanks for that statement, Bill. So maybe, Mark,
well,
you could,
there you go, brother.
Okay.
no, I mean, you know, look, there's a number of provisions in the Affordable Care Act that push, cost sharing onto the backs of workers. Now, and that's not to say that everything in the ACA is bad for working people.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that are, you know, really important. You know, the expansion of coverages, the minimum standards for coverages, elimination of lifetime maximums, all of these issues, you know, have real benefits for working people. But nonetheless, you know, that for, and I don't want to, you know, we could spend hours on this and we get deep into the weeds, but you know, basically we think that it accelerates the race to the bottom on health care benefits, and it does it in a few ways. The first way is, you know, they actually draw a roadmap to the bottom by setting up these tiered benefits. From, you know, if you look at the benefits available under the Affordable Care Act, you'll find that they, you know, you can buy a platinum policy, which is designed to cover about 90% of your health care costs, and then you can go down to gold and silver and bronze, which is designed to cover about 60% of your health care costs. And anybody who's ever had a major family medical crisis will know that a 60% coverage is not going to keep most families out of bankruptcy and financial destitution.
And then
so they basically draw a map to go downward. Now they're talking about a copper plan to cover only 50%. And as we've learned in other areas of bargaining, when you start racing to the bottom, you find out that there's no bottom there. You can always go lower.
Yes.
And that's where we see our health care benefits going. In addition to that, they are instituted a excise tax that they've mistakenly called the Cadillac tax. Well, basically, over a number of years, it won't be a sudden assault because people's benefits cost various amounts. But over a number of years, will basically force most workers who have a halfway decent health and welfare plan either to have to accept cuts in their benefits or pay a whole lot more for their benefits. And this is an intentional provision in the plan. It goes to these market-based theorists who believe that if workers have, they keep calling it skin in the game, if they have a financial incentive to shop for better care, that somehow when you're lying on the ground with a heart attack, you're going to call around and find the cheapest hospital to treat you. I mean, it's a ridiculous theory when you apply it to medical care, because shopping for health care is not the same as shopping for gym shorts. But, you know, this is a dynamic that's also going to push cost cutting. And then finally, and this gets really complicated, but just trust me that, and talk to anybody who works with these plans, the union-sponsored health and welfare funds, often called Taft-Hartley plans, are going to be put at a huge competitive disadvantage and are going to be almost pushed out of business. And then, you know, those benefits will be replaced by inferior state exchange benefit plans. So that's sort of the overview of how things will get worse or tougher for working people who are trying to hold on to decent benefits that they've negotiated through their employers.
It's like a union plumber friend of mine said the other day, that was a while back, he said, it just insults me that they call my health insurance through my union a Cadillac. He goes, it's a Pinto at best. I mean, it's adequate, but it's nothing to really brag about, you know. So, and also the thing too, Mark, is that, and this is from my own personal experience, as well as other working people I know who don't qualify for Medicaid, is that we can go on these, get these plans, either a bronze or, you know, the next step up, but, you know, we're looking at premiums we could barely afford, if at all, and on top of that, $5,000 to $6,000 deductibles before they'll even pay $1, and then $100 copays.
Yep. Well, people are finding that the right to buy health insurance doesn't necessarily mean that you have the right to health care.
Correct.
And that's, you know,
a very important distinction. Yep. Okay, so moving right along, I guess, you know, either what's going on nationally and or Vermont, whatever order you want to do.
Well, let me do the national and then it'll roll right into Vermont,
okay.
I think, from our perspective.
Sure.
So the terms of thinking strategically about where to go, which, you know, we discussed in August, you know, it's pretty clear that we're at a real blockage in terms of moving forward on a national level for healthcare reform. You know, the Congress is massively dysfunctional. You can't get anything out of the Congress. The new Congress that just was installed last week is going to be even worse.
Yes.
You know, they're going to block everything. Mm-hmm. You know, the only thing you can hope for on a national level is that things won't get worse. And trust me, there's going to be a number of attacks on both some of the better provisions of the Affordable Care Act and on Medicare and, you know, a number of social programs that affect working people coming out of this Congress. So, you know, we don't see that we're going to leap forward with new reform at a national level in this Congress and possibly even the next Congress. You know, it's going to take years to get back to the capacity to make change on a national level. So we see that the fights and the focus has really moved to the states, and that, you know, we see a number of vibrant state reform efforts that are trying to institute a single-payer style reform at the state level. And we see that that could really help rebuild momentum back into a national health care reform. So, you know, our strategic vision is to encourage and support grassroots state campaigns that have significant and substantial support in states where they can win it. And that doesn't mean every state. I mean, in a number of states, particularly the red states, you know, the fight there is to get them to accept the federal funding that would allow them to expand Medicaid coverage to a broader segment of the working poor in their states. And, you know, that's sort of a fight that is also a fight for health care justice that we support. But in the blue states in particular, in states with effective and labor organizations, we think that that's really where the potential is. And we talked about a number of exciting projects around the country. Am I still on the air? I'm hearing some.
Yes, we're listening intentively here. Sorry.
Okay. We talked about some exciting projects around the country. On the West Coast, there's some campaigns going on all down the West Coast, Washington, Oregon, and California, that are working to institute single-payer reforms through state initiative and referendum campaigns.
And
they even think about coordinating them up and down the West Coast.
Oh, interesting.
And
then, and California,
New York has made amazing advances towards a single-payer bill in New York. A number of labor organizations have jumped in big time, and that's kind of changed the politics in New York. So they're very hopeful that we can move forward in New York.
And California California came real close a couple times in the past, didn't they?
Yeah, they passed it through the legislature when Schwarzenegger was governor, and he vetoed it twice. Then they had a Democratic governor. They have a Democratic governor and Democratic majorities in both houses, and now they can't get a bill out of committee in California, which, you know, made folks to kind of take a step back and realize, you know, they really, you know, this is a movement building challenge. You know, because of the vast economic forces that oppose healthcare reform, you've got to build a powerful movement from the grassroots.
Yes.
And you know, in states that allow for referendum, that's a really good way to kind of organize. You know, to take a look at what it would take to win a statewide referendum for healthcare and impose it through the popular will. And it's not easy. And the folks in California have really sat down and, you know, they've analyzed it because they've gone through a number of referendum campaigns, and they know that it means that you have to raise millions of dollars and you've got to put tens of thousands of people on the streets to walk precincts and make phone calls. And, you know, you really have to get those metrics up to build it. But they're putting together the kind of plan that could run and win an effective referendum campaign.
You know, ironically, the marijuana legalization referendums in Colorado and Washington State is kind of a model. I mean, who would have thought 5 years ago that would have happened?
Yeah, that's a very good model, although I have to warn you that the forces who are opposed to marijuana legalization are not as powerful as the forces who want to maintain the for-profit medical system. I mean, you know, you have a number of forces, you know, who are opposed to it. But, you know, when you're talking about undermining the biggest, most profitable industry in the history of capitalism, which is what the medical industrial complex in this country is,
mm-hmm.
You know, you're talking about an order of magnitude greater in terms of opposition.
Yes.
Which kind of brings us to Vermont.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how much time we have.
Oh, go, keep going. We're as much time as you need, Mark.
Well, Vermont was leading the way in single-payer health care reform. In 2011, the legislature passed a bill, Act 48, which established something called Green Mountain Care, which would be a publicly financed universal health care system for the state of Vermont. And they set up a series of steps that they needed to take to move the state forward to implement Green Mountain Care. And basically, under the Affordable Care Act, beginning in 2017, you can apply to the federal government for waivers to establish alternatives to an Affordable Care Act-style healthcare system in a state. And the waivers can be given as long as the state's plan covers at least as many people as the Affordable Care Act would cover and doesn't cost the federal government any more than what they would have paid out of the under the Affordable Care Act, which sets a pretty broad range of opportunity there. So under the Act 48, the governor was supposed to appoint commissions to develop proposals for how to pay for Green Mountain Care and, you know, for what the plan design would be, how what would be covered, whether there'd be any co-pays, all of those type of things. And he delayed his recommendations a year until after the most recent governor's election, which took place in November. He was widely supported by the supporters of single payer in the state of Vermont in this election because he promised that he would be implementing Green Mountain Care after the election. It was a very close election, like in a lot of states. There was a kind of a conservative reaction that took place, very low voter turnout. He almost lost.
And there was a third party candidate that ran as well, wasn't there?
Yes. Well, there's a number of third parties in Vermont. There is a progressive party, which sort of is sort of the Bernie Sanders party
mm-hmm.
in Vermont. That's very well established. It has several state senators, several state assembly people, number of other elected officials around the state. They chose not to run against the governor, who's a Democrat,
mm-hmm.
Because of his support for single payer and some other progressive initiatives. And
okay.
then there was a Libertarian candidate who ended up getting 6 or 7% of the vote,
mm-hmm.
And a Republican candidate, and then Governor Shumlin. So
mm-hmm.
Shumlin did not win a majority, but he did win a plurality, and that puts it in the state legislature, and they declared him governor last week.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a lot of the health insurance industry and their friends never really accepted the inevitability of Green Mountain Care in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
And they have been organizing both publicly and behind the scenes ever since the passage of the bill in 2011. And, you know, they've been sending out these messages that to implement Green Mountain Care, you'd have to institute the largest tax increase in the history of Vermont, and the state isn't ready for such an economic shock, and, you know, just kind of hammering away on people's fears and insecurity. And,
which was not based on any fact, actually. I mean, the Green Mountain Care was...
It's based on a distortion of facts.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because medical costs are close to 20% of, you know, the national domestic product.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's a huge amount of money. And, you know, right now it's a private insurance system, public-private, because you have, you know, Medicaid and CHIPS and a number of other public systems. And the private insurance system, which goes through for-profit and so-called non-profit insurance companies, and they get their cut, but, you know, that's a huge amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's personal financing, you know, when you're paying all of your co-pays and deductibles and everything else. So when you add all that stuff up, it comes out to, you know, big bucks. And so when you're shifting from private insurance to public insurance, you know, the revenues that you raise, you could call them taxes, you could call them premiums, you can call them whatever, but it's a lot of money that you're going to have to transfer from this sort of inequitable, fragmented private financing system into one big pool of public money. In the end, everybody or almost everybody is going to save money. But, you know, the transition is, you know, it can be difficult. And that's sort of where the opponents of single payer were focusing their energy on, just trying to prevent any equitable financing system from emerging. And they were temporarily successful right before Christmas, after the election. Conveniently, the governor announced that he took another look at the financing and he could not recommend a financing package to establish Green Mountain Care in Vermont in 2017, and that it would just cost too much money and be too disruptive to the economy of Vermont. He put out a report, which is available online, if anybody wants to take a look at it, that justifies his decision. And, you know, it caused a huge ferment both within Vermont and nationally, and people have taken a begun to take a look at this report. A number of prominent economists who have looked at financing, how to finance single payer, are taking a look at it. You know, it's pretty clear that, first of all, he picked the worst of all, worst possible scenarios to use as inputs and assumptions in terms of financing. He didn't, or the panel that did it for him, didn't include any savings at all for possible administrative savings.
Yes.
When most economists have predicted administrative savings of, you know, anywhere from 10 to 25%.
Yeah, I'm looking at a report actually by a professor, an economics professor, Friedman. And it's just real clear from this analysis he did that yeah, there would be some initial startup costs, so to speak, but that the savings over a five-year time would amount to over $3 billion.
Yeah, Professor Friedman actually went even further than that. He looked at the lousy plan that the governor said was the only way to finance it. And he said that even if you use his numbers and his method of financing, which was not all that progressive, you know, working people would have had to pay more than under a number of other alternatives. Even if you do all that, still 95% of all Vermonters would save money from what they're currently paying for health care. So the conclusion that many people have reached is that the governor's decision was not based on the economics, that it was based on the politics of health care. It was a political decision. And there are efforts underway as we speak in Vermont to overturn and change the politics of health care. The governor was inaugurated on Thursday. There was a huge, for Vermont, a huge mobilization in the state capitol. It was something like 20 below zero, but they still brought out hundreds of people into the streets of the state capitol. A number of folks went into the capitol and took over the state house when the governor was giving his address and sat in the state house. The demand right now in Vermont is that the state legislature begin to hold hearings to figure out, you know, what the governor's proposal means for Vermont and to see whether there's any other alternatives. So we've been joining with a number of other national organizations to call on the state legislature and the governor to reconsider and to sit down and figure out how they can work out an effective transition to single payer in Vermont. And this is important, not just for Vermont, which is, you know, a relatively small small state and doesn't really have a huge impact on the national economy and national politics. But it's important because it's a symbol for what is possible in other states. And, you know, we think that the National Movement for Healthcare Justice really needs to help keep the pressure on and keep the focus on Vermont as they try to work through these political fights. But again, it goes to show what it's going to need to take to win a real healthcare system for everyone in America. It's going to take a huge fight. It's going to take a grassroots fight from the bottom up. We're fighting huge entrenched economic power, and it's not going to be easy, and we can't relax. Even when we think we've won, we've got to keep on fighting. We've got to keep the pressure on. We've got to educate the public in terms of this stuff. It could be very complicated, and it's people are very scared to think about, changes in their health care policy, and the other side really preys on those kinds of fears and insecurities.
Yes, you know, most working people I know are afraid of change because they state that in their most of their adult lifetime, any change that's come has been for the worse. You know, yep. Politically, socially, whatever, you know, you want to look at it as far as living standards and stuff. Mark, I wanted to remind the listeners out there that this law that came about in Vermont wasn't just done by out of the goodness of the heart of the governor or the legislator. This was a 2-year intense grassroots battle even to get to that point, correct?
Oh, that's for sure. It was an amazing fight, and it really was a model for how we're going to win it nationally. You know, they went to every community in Vermont. Almost all of the unions in Vermont ultimately lined up behind this, which is a big move to get unions to, you know, recognize that their members will be better off in a publicly financed universal health care system. And, you know, they put serious resources in. There's an organization called Vermont Workers Center, which is a grassroots labor-aligned movement. They had people in every single town meeting in the state of Vermont over the last several years talking about this and passing resolutions. The doctors have been working on this, small businesses. It's been a real model for how you build a popular coalition to win a fight like this. And, you know, we've got to sustain that model. We've got to keep on fighting until we win.
Okay, Mark. Well, listen, thank you so much for calling in today. And, you know, maybe sometime here, definitely before summer, you'll have to call in with another update because, you know, I'll tell you, this was a very good, concise report you gave today on a very huge subject matter.
Well, I'm glad to do it, and I'd love to join you whenever you, you want to hear from me.
Okay, very good. Take care.
Take care.
Okay, bye. Okay, we're back. That was Ann Feeney, and that's it in a nutshell, folks. Rich folks live and the poor folks die under our current privatized healthcare system. Just some quick public service announcements here. Another sports show with fellow worker Neil Parthen is on today and every Saturday from 2 to 3 at WRFU 104.5. You can also catch it on Wednesday evenings on Comcast Channel 6 or Band of Public Televisions. And Again, that's today from 2 to 3 at 104.5. And also this Sunday and every Sunday, tune in to 9/11 television from 3 to 4 on Comcast Channel 6, Urbana Public Television, and live at urbanapublictelevision.org. And that's followed by Labor's Worldview from 4 to 5 p.m. also on Comcast Channel 6. And this week on Labor's Worldview is a film from 1968 called Revolution 2. Very interesting wow. film about how some poor white Southerners in the north, they called the Uptown area of Chicago, which is up by Wilson and Broadway, actually organized with the Black Panther Party against poverty and police brutality. And it's quite an amazing film that I discovered at the Champaign Public Library of all places.
What was the name of that, Dave?
It's called Revolution 2.
Revolution 2.
Yes. And Bob?
Yeah, public service announcement for you here. Prairie Crossroads Blues Society is hosting a IBC fundraiser today, starting at 5 o'clock at Bentley's.
Oh, okay.
They're sending their solo duo winners, Monica Morris and Josie Louder, down to Memphis to compete in the International Blues Challenge down there. And it kicks off at 5 o'clock. I think they're going to have Susan Williams with special guest Bob Watson on guitar. Jiggy and the Source going to be there, the Diva and the Dude, and Monica Morris and Josie Louder, and they're going to raise a few dollars to help send the duo down to Memphis to compete in this blues challenge.
Okay, great, great. Okay, so right before the caller called in, Bill and I were talking about this Bill Maurer thing, and we're talking about the police union. And my reference, this is not to be confused. First of all, I think that's a great statement by Maurer. And my reference, it might have been a little confusing to some of the listeners that haven't been following what's been going on nationally. But basically, my reference was in relation to the president of the New York City Police Department Union. What's his name? Gosh, I can't think of his name.
I forgot to.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, he's basically started a war. Pretty much, if you will, a public relations war against Mayor de Blasio of New York, because Mayor de Blasio, you know, basically made statements, that, said, you know, that we should be concerned about racism and police brutality. And, so now I guess, you know, the police there, I guess, have kind of went on a de facto sort of strike, starting, about a week or so ago, to where they, they're only, gonna police serious crimes. In other words, they're not gonna write parking tickets and other violations, and a lot of people think this is great.
Well, that was part, actually Bill Maher was referring to that earlier in his piece there.
Yeah.
And, what was it? It's like, parking tickets are way, 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 way down. Public drunkenness arrests are way, way, way down. Uh-huh. Public urination arrests are way, way, way down.
Yeah.
So, he figured that was a good time to go to New York and, pee out the window, get drunk and pee out the window of your double parked car.
Yes, indeed. Now, of course, the reason they're doing this is not because they're wanting to give the public a break. It's because they want to deprive the city of New York of revenue that comes from these tickets, you know. And but basically, you know, what my reference was is that, you know, there's been stuff on various Facebook pages and stuff of police from different police departments around the country, but especially from New York City, equating anti-police brutality protesters with ISIS terrorists.
Yeah, well, see, one of the big things we have, big problems with American police is, they're apparently afraid of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Right there. Like, oh, yeah, anti-police protesters or ISIS, you know. They, see, one of their problems is, something called consciousness raising.
Mm-hmm.
Which a lot of people might probably associate with a positive thing because consciousness is being raised. Well, no, that is not a good thing. Actually, consciousness raising techniques were, the theory was done at the University of Minnesota. And, what they did, it was found with, they were studying, interestingly enough, gay liberation groups.
Oh, really?
And what they find is that people get together in groups and they talk about problems they have and so on and so forth. And the raising of the consciousness is that they're becoming more identified and solidified with the group. And that's what happens with all kinds of groups. And when you have people with guns and basically license to kill, that could be very dangerous.
Yes.
They become insular. And, but I think that one of the things that we should really be looking at here, and this isn't just the police union, it's not just the prison guards union getting more laws passed so they have to have more jail cells to guard and hire more prison guards, build more prisons. It's not just, It's also the laborers union wanting to build the Keystone XL pipeline. It's, say, the carpenters union perhaps wanting to build a new jail in town here.
Mm-hmm.
It's all of these. And what these unions have to start doing is return, or if we ever had it, become social movement unions, and they're going to have to educate their members.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to have to educate them, tell them, yes, there is global warming. Your children and grandchildren are greatly going to suffer. And we believe this so much that we are willing to, you know, give up these jobs and try and get some other jobs building something better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and but they're just, the police unions are just a glaring example of it's that vision thing, short-sightedness. I was trying to think of the other of American unions.
Okay,
you know, in a lot of ways, the narrow focus on just their
yes.
I mean, Dave, you know, laborers and carpenters pick at each other.
I know.
You know, it's just.
I hear you, Bill. Yes, indeed. Of course, that's a little problematic because, for instance, your example of building the new jail, say in Champaign County or wherever, if the union tradesmen don't do it, the non-union contractors will do it. So that's a problem, you know, for sure. You know, so that's got to be dealt with somehow. I'm not saying that
if the jail's not built at all.
Yeah, but if there's something else in basically an alternative to building a jail, like say a mental health center, which is what's really needed instead of a new jail, would be a creative way of, say the building trade unions, to get on board with community activists and support to say, look, we agree with them, but we don't want nothing built because we think there is something that needs to be built, and that's a mental health center.
Well, and Bill Maher, that would also help with the other problem Bill Maher mentioned, which is the view of the American people of unions and union members as coddled crybabies who get whatever they want and everything else, is by getting back with your community, working with other community groups more.
Yes, and that is especially true of the police.
Yes.
Because there's definitely a problem because, you know, the slogan protect and serve, you got to wonder with recent events who exactly they're protecting and serving, you know, because it seems like it's the ruling class and not the majority working class out there that the police are protecting most of the time. Now, of course, we both know, Bill, too, that this has been a traditional problem for over a century, you know, with labor and the police, you know. It's very rare where police have refused to go and beat the heads in of striking workers when they were ordered to.
Yes, that is correct. Or pepper gas workers like
at Staley.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And going back further, we had a guest recently talking about slavery.
Yes.
And there's a lot of areas where the police came out of slave patrols.
Yes.
That's
indeed
how they started,
yes,
rather than law enforcement.
Yeah. And it's interesting, citations that have been written in New York City, you know, for public urination, drunkenness, whatever, are down 90%, you know. And I saw an article the other day that said, hey, this is the police probably don't want to admit to it, but they've just basically solved this whole police community problem in a nutshell, you know, in a sense by doing this.
Well, I bet there's not as much stop and frisk going on.
Yes.
The police are not endangering themselves as much by being out harassing people.
Yes, yeah, indeed.
And writing, and probably a lot of those tickets that were being written to begin with were pretty bogus anyway.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
it's the kind of thing where somebody's not going to go get hire a lawyer about.
Indeed.
For selling loose cigarettes without charging taxes.
Yes. I mean, are you kidding me? Wow, what a dangerous criminal. But anyway, you've been listening to the World Labor Hour.
He was big and he was black.
Yeah.
And I'm just a little white guy.
Yeah, with a gun, mace, and a billy club and four other cops with me. Yeah. Yeah, right. Okay, you've been listening to the World Labor Hour on listener support community radio station WFT in Champaign. Till next week, be safe and power the people. Stay tuned for the Union Edge with host Charles Showalter. Take care.